Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the show today. News anchor Katie Couric describes my guest today as a woman who does not know the meaning of the word impossible. She's a phenomenal woman, a woman who climbs some of the world's toughest mountains with someone else's heart beating in her chest. Given just a week to live, Kelly Perkins received an emergency heart transplant. She later shocked the medical world by becoming the first ever heart transplant recipient to peak some of the world's most challenging mountains, including one of the infamous seven summits, Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa. As remarkable as that story is, Kelly Perkins' story is about much more than recovery. It's about much more than overcoming obstacles. It's also the most beautiful and incredible love story, a husband and wife comeback story that's a true testament to courage, the commitment to love, and the relentless desire to live life on their terms. Kelly is also she's also a leading crusader for organ, blood, and tissue donation, and she's been featured in media such as the New York Times and on NBC's Today Show. Kelly Perkins, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. Good to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, and I should say also that you wrote a book about your journey, and it's called The Climb of My Life, Scaling Mountains with a Borrowed Heart. And I wanted to start out, Kelly, with the story of your fifth anniversary, because that really was a huge turning point for you. You have this wonderful life that you and your husband, Craig, have built for yourselves. You say that life was great. You were living with your soulmate. You were financially stable. Your careers were going well. And you'd been hiking in the Swiss Alps to celebrate your fifth anniversary.
And Actually, it was our fifth anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
So we had saved up to go on this like wonderful trip over to Europe and just put on a backpack and travel as far as we could go and just basically wander and have a great time. And like you said, it was after coming back from that trip that our life was just kind of derailed, you might say. And the shock of it all was that I was so healthy before and going into this, and like you said, our life was so stable in every other way that we couldn't really imagine that it would be any different than that.
Right.
But all of a sudden it all came to an end when I began to notice my heart. And of course, all of you out there listening know that you don't really notice your heart on a regular basis. And that's when we knew something was dramatically wrong with me.
Yeah, and by noticing your heart, you experienced severe palpitations, correct?
Right. And everybody, I want to clarify that a lot of people experience extra heartbeats. That's very common. But it depends on what part of the heart your extra beats are coming from. And in my case, they were coming from my left ventricle, which is the main pumping chamber in your heart. And usually, if you've got an issue in that part of the heart, your issues are not easily resolved, which was my case.
Now, you didn't know that to begin with, though, did you? The first doctor you went to see, you say actually that July 92 were your last days of innocence, and you went to the doctor and the EKG checked out normal, just a few skipped beats, and he gave you the business card of a psychiatrist and told you it was just stress, right?
Yes. Actually, it's funny because I was so calm and our life was, I mean, of course I went to him because I was noticing my heart. So I was a little alarmed about that, but I wasn't a reactive type person anyway. I'm pretty low key anyway. And for him to give me a card to see a psychiatrist was quite a shock. My husband got a good chuckle out of it, though, for a moment. Like, maybe you should see a psychiatrist. but no, it was only when I went back 30 days later And I again asked him, you know, if he would listen to me, that he, while I was sitting on the examination table, I wasn't running around or doing anything unusual. I was sitting on the examination table, and that's when he captured my resting heart rate at 200 beats per minute. Mm-hmm. Now, my normal resting rate had been 50 beats per minute, so this was four times my normal rate. So that, you know, when you get into those ranges, the high, you know, right around 200, you're a candidate for sudden cardiac death, and that's what was really frightening, and the beginning of really my medical drama. From that point on.
Now, you were very fit. You describe yourself as petite. You were very fit. You and your husband were used to hiking all over the place.
Right.
So what did you think was going on here? I mean, what caused this? It was actually a viral infection, I believe, correct?
Right. So, yeah, there was no, of course, I had no family history, and my lifestyle certainly wouldn't lead to any kind of heart disease, especially at 30 years old. And when I went to the doctor, just, you know, they didn't really know what the cause was until they did a heart biopsy. And the heart biopsy results indicated the type of damage that they saw on the tissue of my heart indicated that it was a viral cause. And they call it idiopathic because they don't really know where the type of virus comes from. And they also think that it could be a virus that could have gone anywhere in my body, but for some reason it attached to my heart and caused damage. And the type of damage it was caused is it caused scarring on the surface of my heart, which caused interruptions in the electrical cycle, which set me off into these really fast arrhythmias.
Yeah, and I don't know if our listeners caught this, but you were just 30 years old when this was happening, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So describe to us
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, describe to us what was going through your mind then. You know, you're 30 years old and you've kept yourself fit and active. How are you feeling at this point?
Well, it's funny. I didn't really believe anything could really be seriously wrong. In fact, I really thought the first doctor who told me the results had said that your heart is real inflamed. And my first response was, well, can't I take an anti-inflammatory, like an aspirin?
Yeah.
Won't that help?
Right.
And he was like, no, I think we've got more serious problems than that. But I really couldn't process that it was as bad as it was until I was told that I was going to be airlifted from Orange County, which is just an hour south of Los Angeles. I was going to be airlifted to Los Angeles, and not driven, but airlifted. And I thought, okay, we've got something serious going on here. Mm. So it was quite frightening. And again, having no past history of any kind of medical situation, I was still kind of, you know, our heads were spinning. Like, what? This just can't be. And you know, you never think that your life can change in a moment, but in that moment that I was airlifted, my life very much changed.
Right.
And will forever be changed.
Now, your husband, Craig, was with you at your side at that time, but he was not allowed to be airlifted with you. He had to drive separately to the hospital, right?
Right.
Tell us.
And that was pretty daunting.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell us how that was for you, because you described that in the book.
Yeah, it was just really hard because I could just see the fear he had all over his face, and to have to say, you know, see you later and I'll meet you up at Los Angeles, was, you know, when you're going through something so terrifying, you just want to hang on to your loved ones and just have them be with you at your side at all times. And Craig and I are, as you mentioned before, it's very much a love story. We are connected, I mean, in every way. And so to say goodbye was really, really scary for us.
Mm.
And but one beautiful thing about, I mean, I feel very fortunate, and that's why I wanted to share this in the book, that, you know, it is a love story, and I am a success story, and I think those stories need to get out there. But Craig told me in the very, very beginning that this did not happen to me, it happened to us. And he stayed true to that comment to this day. I mean, it did absolutely happen to both of us. So I had a partner moving through, you know, forward with this whole illness, which was really, and that was my best medicine for sure.
Yeah, you described that in the book. Craig said you'd broken down in his arms, and he said, this is not happening to you, it's happening to us. We're a team, and we're going to pull through this together.
Right, right.
You said... Go ahead. We've got a little kickback. I think we have a little kickback echo. Yeah, that's okay. I was just going to say that you describe Craig as somebody who's never at a loss for words, but he was strangely silent when all this was happening.
Yeah, I just think you're in such shock. You're afraid to say the wrong thing as well, and you're almost afraid to think too much because you're afraid of just where you might go, and it's terrifying facing what we were facing. As far as when I did get admitted, I was admitted to Good Samaritan in Los Angeles, and my options at that point in time were anything from a medication that would enable my heart to rest and recover, which would take a few months, but there was that likelihood that that could happen, or as extreme as a heart transplant. So, of course, those are huge extremes, and you just don't want to go to really what that means yet, especially at 30 years old. You know, 30 years old, if I looked at my friends, they were all building futures. They were all focused on, you know, getting pregnant and starting a family, you know, saving up for a home. You know, they were building. And Craig and I were just pulled out of this whole, like, this whole life that we had and this path we were going down. And we were just trying to stay afloat. You know, we were trying to just hang on to life.
Sure.
And it was very much uncharted waters for us. You know, having just being our age and not having any family members who had even gone through anything as significant medically as we were going through.
Mm. So let's. You were lifted to was it Sacred Heart?
No, Good Samaritan.
Good Samaritan.
Uh huh.
And you were airlifted there, and then they put you on drugs. Is that when you had that device implanted in you?
Right. What they did immediately, they wanted to put in what they call a defibrillator. And some people might recognize that term from Dick Cheney had one put in. And what that does is it's like the paramedic paddles, but it's implanted in your system. So, or in your abdomen, in my case. And so what happens is if there's a breakthrough in my medication where it's not working for some reason, this device will shock my heart back into a sinus rhythm if it goes too fast. And so it's basically like having a little paramedic walking around next to you all the time, and just in case something happens. So, but this is, you know, built in, which is wonderful technology, by the way. But 15 years ago, when I first had my, one of the the more antiquated versions of the device, it just delivered a big, powerful shock. Nowadays, they actually pace you before they give you the big shock. So that was really, really scary living with that because my heart was so out of control. And in fact, over a three-year period of time, three defibrillators implanted because I had used up so much battery life from just controlling my heart that they needed to replace them to replace the battery and put them back in.
Wow.
So I was really controlled by mechanically. I was the bionic woman in every way. My heart was. Yeah.
I read in the book you said that after the surgery, you describe yourself as being in a perpetual state of low-grade panic. Part of you is grateful for the safety net of the device, but you are also constantly waiting for it to fire. So how
exactly?
How did you learn to separate? I read somewhere, I'm not sure if it was that section or a little further on in the book, that you actually had to compartmentalize your body into organs and head.
Yes, it's very true. Actually, the medical industry does help you there because, the heart doctors are so specialized on the heart that kind of gives you a foot in the door as far as learning how to do that. But I did. I really had to try to separate my emotions from my physical. And as everyone knows, we're all very much connected. Call it Eastern medicine, whatever you want, but our brains and our hearts are connected. And so emotionally, when you react to something, you will have physical responses. I mean, just fear is a perfect example. If someone scares you, your heart might beat faster. But so I was terrified to express any emotion. If it was emotional happy or emotional sad, I was afraid that anything I did mentally might have a physical effect on my heart, which may thereby increase my heart rate that might cause me to get shocked. So as you can imagine, I basically walked around in fear that this device might just go haywire and I might get multiple shocks. And it happened more than a few times, which didn't help my confidence in the device.
I'm sure. I can't imagine having something implanted in me like that. It just it kind of freaks me out, but it's better than the alternative.
That's just it. And it's very bittersweet because your logical mind says, of course, that's a wonderful thing to have. But when you're getting shocked, it's really, there's no way not to fear that shock might not end.
Sure,
that it might just keep going. You might get multiple shocks. You don't want to go there anyway. But again, it saved so many lives. It's a fabulous piece of medical equipment.
Right.
That's out there. And it has come a long way since I had mine.
Right.
In fact, now they even implant them up in the shoulder.
Oh, do they really?
Where they do pacemakers. Yeah, they're much smaller. In fact, they call them jewels now. Mm-hmm. In my days, they look more like those old Walkmans. I mean, they were really big.
Wow.
And I'm really little. I'm 100 pounds. So as you can imagine, this thing it looked kind of funky on me, but that was the least of my concerns at the time.
Sure. Well, let's...
I mean, truly.
Yes, really. Let's take a break.
I didn't really worry about what I look like. I just want to get through the days.
I can imagine. Let's take a break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about your actual transplant and then how you went on to actually climb some of the world's most challenging mountains from that. And I actually have a copy of Kelly's book to give away. We'll do that when we come back from the break. So please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest today is Kelly Perkins. Her book, The Climb of My Life, Scaling Mountains with a Borrowed Heart. Please stay with us.
Ready to mobilize your emotional rocket fuel to unleash the inner feeling that will boost you from going through the motions to living with power and unparalleled confidence? Then tune in to Confidence on Demand. It's the topic on Monday's December 17th Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Renowned peak performance expert Pete Siegel joins Vicky for a lively discussion that'll give you the tools to step out with power. No more lurking in the background or second-guessing yourself. Learn to develop confidence on demand right here, Monday, December 17th, on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Check out conversationslive.net for more information.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a PAWS Foster Care Volunteer. For more information, visit PAWS.org or 425-787-2500. PAWS.org or 425-787-2500.
The Art of Constructive Living is alive and well on The Gary Mance Show, Tuesdays at noon. It's your personal power lunch with a variety of experts serving up fresh ideas to take you from where you are in life to where you want to be. Sit down to a banquet for your brain, and I'll pick up the check. Join me every Tuesday at noon for the Gary Mance Show, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 KKNW.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show at its new time, Fridays at noon, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Listen live at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. Thank you for being with us today. My guest is Kelly Perkins. Her book, The Climb of My Life, Scaling Mountains with a Borrowed Heart. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And this is truly a remarkable story. It's the story of a young woman who had a heart transplant in her early 30s. But the story is much more than a story of recovery and overcoming obstacles. It's also a truly beautiful love story between husband and wife and the journey that they took. And there's also some good mountaineering stories in there too. So there's a little bit of everything in there. And I actually have a copy of the book that I'd like to offer to one of our listeners today, if they'd like. And Kelly, I wonder if you'd just tell us, the book came out in 2007. Your journey began back in, was it 92?
Right, 1992.
So what prompted right. you to write the book now?
Well, you know, it took a while to get my arms around the story, and quite honestly, going back to that whole medical period pre-transplant was something that it was really hard for me to do, and I really wanted to sit down and write it myself, and like I said, it just took me a while to be able to really sit down and really figure out what I wanted to say in this book. But I always knew I wanted to write a book because through my climbs post-transplant, I've actually received so many emails from people that I can tell are so desperate for any sign of hope for their own situations. And I just felt that it was almost, you know, that I was blessed and I had what I interpreted as huge burden that landed on my shoulders, and I then realized I had an opportunity here that I could turn into hope for other people. So,
yeah, and it definitely does that. It's a very, very inspirational book on many levels. So let me bring in Eric Ryder, and we'll see. Hi, Eric, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good to see you. Let's go ahead and throw our phone lines open and offer a copy of this book to a listener, and I'll let you pick the lucky number today.
All right. Why don't we go with lucky number 5 today? Caller number 5 at 425-373-5527. That's 425-373-5527, or toll-free in Western Washington. That's 888-298-KKNW, 888-298-5527. 69. If you're caller number 5, you'll win a copy of the book today.
All right. Thanks, Eric. So, Kelly, let's get back to your story here, because you lived for 2 or 3 years, I believe, in and out of hospitals, you and your husband, Craig. He was always at your side.
Right.
So he lived
right,
the journey,
right.
too. And suddenly you were at one point given just a week to live. And
right.
What happened then?
Well, it's interesting. We were actually back east on just a little vacation. It's funny because we got permission to go from my doctor, and we were only out there for like a week. And upon coming back through Los Angeles, I passed out at the airport, and that's when I was readmitted to the hospital. And at that time, we knew that there was no way that I was going to go home with the same heart. I was in pretty bad shape. But what happens is you, with a heart that's failing, a lot of times it will remain status quo for a long period of time. And then when it begins to really fail, it happens very fast. And in my case, it happened there at the end in about a period of a week to where I went to congestive heart failure. And what that means is that your heart is so weak that it's barely pumping. The blood that it's pumping is not actually getting out through your extremities. And so what's happening is it's pulling in your heart. And when this happens, the blood backs up in your other organs, like your liver and kidneys. And I was actually really puffy in my stomach because all of my other organs were swollen from the lack of fluid being pumped throughout my system. Mm. So that's when I became really critical, and I could not be released from the hospital because my life was sustained by IV drugs only. And that was really scary because at that time that I was in that critical condition, I finally got approval to be admitted to UCLA where the heart transplant would take place. But the night that I was going to be transferred, I became too unstable, and they couldn't transfer me. So here we had gone through 3 years of just, you know, waiting for this time to be able to, you know, have a new lease on life.
Sure.
And I had barely, you know, here I'm at the finish line, and I'm too unstable to be transferred. So that was just really, really scary, especially for my family, you know, for Craig and my parents. But finally, they were able to stabilize me, and within I guess the next 12 hours or so, were able to get me over to UCLA to a bed that was waiting for me. And from that point, it was a matter of just waiting for a donor heart to be available. And that's a really, really scary, or not scary, it's interesting because I thought it would be more frightening than it really was. Because it's a heart and you know what is required for you to live, and that is a heart transplant, it's pretty hard to hope that you live because you know what that means. Mm. I mean, that means somebody is not going to make it, and there's the other side of that. So it's interesting because at that moment, just waiting, I was just at such a state of peace. I mean, more than I had been for this 3 years living with my, you know, failing heart. So that time was probably a little harder for my family than it was for me because for some reason, you know, I just felt like, I truly felt, you know, I had struggled with religion this whole time. Like, oh, I should have, like, really paid attention in church because I really don't know what to ask for right
but
now.
You were raised Catholic, weren't you?
I was raised Catholic, yeah. And I was just like, gosh, what I, you know, I honestly, going through this whole process, I had more faith in my doctors and Craig and my dad because they seemed more spiritual than me. I didn't know what to hang on to at the time. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because all of a sudden when I was at that really critical moment, all of a sudden I felt that I had a connection, and I felt just very, very calm, which was a beautiful place to be because it's a very frightening place to be.
Sure. And sometimes I think, I don't know, we have this innate ability to just reach deep down when we're really facing the wall. And at that point, you were facing the wall, weren't you?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. What you said, I think, is so true. I think we all have it, but we don't need to really reveal it until those really big, powerful moments.
Right. You talked in the beginning of the book a little bit about how you're raised Catholic. You talked about how your family shapes you, how our families shape us. How did your family shape you, and how did that help you get through this whole journey?
Well, there's a lot of things there. I think because I was the only girl, and I had three brothers that were all super athletic, and they were kind of the stars of the family. I was always working really hard to be strong and independent on my own. And I think, and also my family history has, there's a little bit of drug and alcohol abuse in my family. And I really looked at that as a positive thing for me personally, as far as maybe I have this inherent resilience towards all these drugs I've had to take, and this is a temporary thing, and I'm going to come out of this strong, even though I've had all these medications and drugs. And I mean, I kid you not, there was a time I was on 28 pills a day, I mean, for probably about a year. And that's just toxic. You know, that was just, it was a really frightening time. And I think I was able to mentally process these negative things and just spin them in a way that they could make me feel good about what I had gone through and where I was and what I was facing.
Right. Well, that's an important skill. It's good you could do that. Now, you get the heart transplant, and I know at that point you did not want to know anything about the donor, and I know you had a lot of scares along the way, and biopsies, one of the first biopsies you had showed that your body was rejecting the heart.
Right.
What was that like for you?
Well, it's really hard. It was, you know, even though they tell you that rejection is very common, it's just one more step that I had gone through that wasn't working. You know, it's like, okay, all these things, it just seemed like, okay, can't we have another chance at maybe having a positive result or positive outcome? And it was almost like, my husband Craig, he really expresses it well. It's like being thrown a life raft, and you're in the middle of the ocean, you're drowning, and you're thrown a life raft, and you discover there's a hole in it. I mean, that's kind of how I felt. Like, here I had the second chance, and it wasn't going to work for me. And sure enough, you know, the doctors would come in and they would tell you that, or they would tell me that, oh, it's okay if this drug didn't work, we'll try this drug. Okay, well, that didn't work, we'll try this. And they kept telling me that they've got all kinds of ammunition to combat this rejection. But we came pretty much to the end of the rope, where there was really nothing more they could do that was a conventional treatment for a rejection. So I had to go through an experimental process that was much like chemotherapy, where what they did, it was called photopheresis. I was the second person at UCLA to go through this process for a transplant. And it took 6 months. And what it was is, what they did was they took a pint of blood out of my system, and they put it through a centrifuge, which separated the white blood cells from the red blood cells, and then they subjected those white blood cells to ultraviolet light, which in a sense sterilized the blood cells, and then they put the blood back into me. So basically they were sterilizing my immune system so my body wouldn't fight against my heart. And that was the miracle cure for me. It took 6 months, but it worked. And interesting enough, they're now doing that more often with people that are having a tough time with the conventional drugs.
Yeah, it's very commonplace now, I believe. I don't know the statistics on that, but I believe it's very commonplace now. So, I mean, still fairly experimental back 15 years ago.
Oh, for sure. Yes. A lot of these things were, and that's the beauty of, you know, living in this era, is the medical progress that's made just every year is just significant. I mean, it's just, in fact, it's just last Tuesday was the 40th anniversary of the first heart transplant.
Oh, really?
Yes,
wow.
And that took place in South Africa in 1967, and the first transplant recipient lived 18 days, and 18 days in bed, and of course died of rejection.
I remember that. But I was a very tiny little girl, but I do remember that.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So it's interesting. We've come a long ways.
It is. And What I want to do now is take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how you've really lived your life. And you've paid homage, really, to the donor of your heart by living life full out. And so I want to talk about that when we come back from break. We're talking today with Kelly Perkins. Her book is called The Climb of My Life, Scaling Mountains with a Borrowed Heart. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Please stay with us.
Take me with you when you go down to the river.
The Sisters of the Moon series, urban fantasy at its best, by USA Today bestselling author Yasmin Gallinor. Camille, Delilah, and Manali, three sexy, half-human, half-fairy sisters, are out to save two worlds, one monster at a time. Romantic Times magazine calls the Sisters of the Moon series vivid, sexy, and mesmerizing. And Publishers Weekly dubs it a whimsical reminder of fantasy's importance in everyday life. Buy Witchling and Changeling from your local Borders, Barnes & Noble, or online. Look for Darkling coming January 2008. For more information, visit Gallinorn and Visions at www.gallinorn.com.
Are you fed up wasting time hunting for things or buying replacements because you can't remember where you put them? Need help getting your home or office space organized, clean, and clutter-free? Organization Plus will help you achieve your goal and save you time, money, and a lot of hassle. Organization Plus offers free phone consultation, in-home assessment and planning, and a full range of home, garage, and office decluttering services. They also offer services, maintenance, and more. Call Linnell at 253-507-2601. That's 253-507-2601 today for your free Organization Plus telephone consultation.
Hi, this is Howard Bono. I'll be hosting a new show called The Money Thing with Howard Bono on Tuesday afternoons from 2 to 3. The show's designed for what I call working America, those of us that are trying to live the American dream but find ourselves getting squeezed financially every day. On the show, we're going to explore the underlying reasons why we're feeling the pinch and some strategies and tricks to help you to understand how money works and how the wealthy handle theirs. My vision is to create 1,000 millionaires, so tune into The Money Thing with Howard Bono on Tuesday afternoons from 2 to 3 here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Join nanny and parenting coach Meryl Woodard for a new parenting show, Another View, Fridays at 2, right here on Alternative Talk 1150 AM, KKNW. This is your chance to get those parenting questions answered, as well as tell us what's working for you. She'll talk about alternative health products, too. So consider Another View, Fridays at 2 on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Radio with no added hormones or preservatives. All natural, Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Make the city slow. Take me with you when you go down to the river.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest today is Kelly Perkins. Her book is called The Climb of My Life, Scaling Mountains with a Borrowed Heart. And the winner of today's book is John Davis in Tacoma. So I'll mail that out this week. And thanks for calling in. And Kelly, I want to talk about some of the fun stuff you've done since this horrible traumatic experience.
Okay.
And I know there are good points in every horrible traumatic experience that we go through. We learn a lot about ourselves. But you,
so true.
Yeah, and you and your husband Craig hiked a lot before your illness. And
right.
You basically picked that up as soon as you were able, I guess. How long was it before you started talking about your first mountain climb?
Well, I actually had my transplant in November. It was in November 25th, so right around Thanksgiving. And that Christmas, Craig gave me, as a Christmas gift, a charm bracelet. And he said, this is to... to collect all your big memories, you know, with your new heart. And I thought, oh, God, that's such a special gift. I want to fill it with mountains that I climb with my new heart. And so, of course, I threw it out there thinking, oh, God, that's a lofty dream. That won't happen. But that's what we did. And my goal was to just climb as many mountains as I could and get back to doing the things we were doing before I ever got sick.
Mm. And you have to share how he used to give these gifts to you, because it was never, here you are, honey, here's a present for you. It was always on the top of a mountain with a spectacular view, or it was always a surprise.
I had to earn them, for sure. There was no doubt about that. But he also surprised me with, you know, he surprised me with the first couple ones. And of course, well, they were, each of the charms were surprises. I never saw the way they were made or anything else. I never saw them until I got to the top of the mountain. But, of course, after a few of them, I came to expect them when I got to the top. But still, it never diluted the powerful, symbolic, you know, what that represented, because that was, because truly every mountain I climb is the best health report I can get. Mm. And so that means so much more than the charm, than the climb. I mean, it means we have our life back. So those charms are very powerful symbols for me to have. So they're very, very special on many levels.
And each mountain, well, I have a list of some of the mountains here that you climbed. I pulled these off your website. And there was significance to actually climbing these mountains. Like, for example, the one you climbed in 1998, you climbed Mount Fuji in Japan. And that was to celebrate a new law that would legalize heart transplantation in Japan. And we said earlier that you, when you had the transplant, you did not want to know anything about your donor. But when you reached the peak of Mount Fuji, Craig actually read a letter to you from the daughter of your donor. There's a photograph there in the book of you buried, you have your face buried in your hands. I assume that was extremely emotional for you.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Well, we had actually made contact, Craig had made contact with the donor while I was traveling with my parents, and that was sometime earlier, and that came about because they had read an article in the paper of one of our prior climbs, and so they kind of connected the dots, and what happened was Craig received a phone call from the daughter of my donor, and it was actually on his message machine. He had come home from work and played the voice message, and the message was, I hope I'm reaching the right Kelly Perkins. I think you have my mother's heart. So this is a message my husband came home and heard on our voice recorder. So you can imagine that was quite a shock right there. Mm. He subsequently made contact and kind of kept it a secret from me because he knew the way I felt, and it wasn't any disrespect on any level. It was more fear of personalizing my donor too much.
Sure.
Because the more real she was, the more traumatic the whole experience was on their side. So I just wasn't quite ready to jump in and know too much information right off the bat. So when we went to Japan, Craig had made contact again, and what he had asked the donor's daughter if she wanted to participate in sending maybe a little note or a request for us to make a wish for them on the top, when we reached the highest point, which hopefully would be the summit. And what he was asking for was what we had come to do. It's a tradition that we had was when we reach any summit, we blow bubbles and make wishes. And so he said, it's really a fun way to celebrate. But so he wanted to know if we could blow some bubbles for him. Well, she said, well, that would be great, but I have a special request. And Craig immediately said, sure, whatever you want, well, I'll be happy to do. And she said, well, would you mind releasing my mother's ashes almost half a Mount Fuji. And Craig said, of course, no problem. And, of course, it wasn't until he hung up the phone that he realized, oh, my God, that's huge. Mm-hmm. And that's really powerful. But, of course, he wanted to do anything he could for the donor's family. So he thought, by telling me this, it might just put too much pressure on me to get to the top. And he just thought, you know, there was pressure enough because we had the Associated Press joining us to follow our climb, to try to be a real-life example of what organ donation can do, what heart donation can do in a country where the laws had just been changed, as you indicated before. So he kept it a secret from me. So it wasn't until we got to the top of the peak there, to the summit, under the full moon, which was just beautiful. We hiked up at night to reach the summit for the rising of the sun, which was just the whole experience was just outstanding. Mm. That's when he pulled me over to the side and told me that he had something special he wanted to share with me. And first of all, he pulled out a letter, and he read the letter to me, which broke me up enough. And then he handed me this little pouch and explained to me what was in that pouch. And, of course, you know, I went through just a period of just happy, sad, just depleted in a sense. I didn't know how to respond to that. It was such a huge moment. But we did walk over to the cone of the volcano, and we released ashes. So that moment was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was more beautiful now looking back at it and realizing that right then and there, this wonderful act that we were able to do enabled me to process it as they really truly are happy that I have their mother's heart, and that it was permission for me to, in a sense, own it instead of for it to be part of me now, where before I felt more like it was, I guess before I felt like many women who are pregnant feel, is they're carrying another life in their belly. I felt like I was carrying another life in my heart. Mm. And suddenly I was able to process it as, okay, this is now mine. I can have ownership of it. It can be part of me. And I still feel like it was part of her there too, but there was just, I just could take it to a new level. That sure. was all. It was just a wonderful experience.
Very moving, very moving.
Yes, it was very moving.
And I know that you went to the Matterhorn. You said that that was like going full circle for you because you had been climbing underneath the shadow of the Matterhorn. And when you got back, that's when you first had heart problems. When they airlifted you to the hospital with your heart problems, the pilot actually banked the plane or the helicopter so you could see the Matterhorn at Disneyland.
Right.
And
right.
So it's inevitable, I guess, that you went back to climb the Matterhorn itself. What was that moment like for you?
Well, I mean, that was amazing because when we were healthy, we looked up at that mountain like, oh, my God, that is for serious alpinists. I mean, only really serious alpinists would even attempt such a climb. And it's true. It's one of those peaks that a lot of people who really know their stuff and they're very practiced and they're strong mountaineers, they have a hard time on that mountain. So, or either that or the weather doesn't cooperate or for whatever reason. And so for us to be able to not be able to do it when I was healthy before there was any sign of heart condition, to go back, you know, years later with a new heart and get to the summit of that peak, it was just amazing. It was such, like you said, such a full circle accomplishment.
Yeah, and it was.
Many
mountaineers that I've spoken with over the years have said that climbing is a metaphor for life, and I know you feel that same way. It's a little different for everyone. How is it a metaphor for life for you?
Well, I think, you know, we all experience what can be perceived as either, you know, if you see a bump in the road, you can perceive that as a place to stumble or a place to step up. And I think mountains are very much that way. It's your approach to life, and they demand that you pull together your body, mind, and spirit, and it's kind of a war between all of those things to get to the summit. And I think it's what happens in life in a big way every day. You know, we all have these things, but I think there's something beautiful about standing on a peak as though you've accomplished that. You know, you were able to step up and not stumble. And I think that's the metaphor that it means to me anyway.
Mm. I know your husband, Craig, is, you actually have been quoted as saying, if one heart can accomplish so much, imagine the power of two. And I know you give a talk on two hearts are better than one. What would this journey have been like for you? How would it have been different for you without Craig at your side?
It wouldn't have turned into the fairy tale that it turned into, for sure. I probably would be healthy and strong, but I don't think I would have taken it to the level we've took it to, and that's to, you know, climbing mountains and sharing our success with other people. When this happened to me, we looked desperately for hopeful stories out there that we could kind of hang our hat on, that, okay, that will be us someday. And we had a hard time finding them. And the bad stories are out there. There are plenty of bad stories. But we felt the power to share our story, to help people like us when we were in that situation and we needed it. But, you know, Craig, he also enjoys, I guess because we had such a love for this type of lifestyle before with the mountaineering and travel and so forth, not a lot of people would completely change their life path and be willing to go in a totally different direction and try to take it to the next level. And we were both, you know, it's all about going down a parallel path together. And we're fortunate that we have been able to do that. And that doesn't always happen it's unlikely it can happen in many cases. So I feel like it's just, my story may have been a success, but it wouldn't have been nearly the success that it's been. And we wouldn't have the wonderful love story that we've been able to share with others through my book.
Right. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Kelly. Your story truly is remarkable, and it was really interesting to read, and I appreciate everything you've shared with us today. I want to give you the opportunity to just give us a 30-second blurb, if you will, because we're running out of time, on the importance of donation.
Right, right. Well, it's just good to, I never like to tell people to sign up to be an organ donor, but I will ask that you just be educated about it and talk to your family members about it. Most states have an online donor registry where you can sign up to be an organ donor. A lot of times, if you have a little a dot on your driver's license that indicates that you want to be a donor. However, if you have not conveyed that to your family, that can be overridden by your family saying no if that time were to come.
Okay.
So it's very important to tell your family members so they can carry out your wishes.
Okay.
Versus have the burden of having to make that decision on their own.
Good advice. Thank you, Kelly.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to give out your website, which is The Climb of My Life, theclimbofmylife.com. And you can find a lot more information about donorship and about Kelly and Craig's adventures on their website. And that brings us to the close of today's show. I really appreciate you joining us today. And please stay tuned to find out what's coming up next week. We had a little change in programming. And meanwhile, live well, live strong, and thanks for joining us on Conversations Live today.
Are you ready to mobilize your emotional rocket fuel to unleash the inner feeling that will boost you from going through the motions to living with power and unparalleled confidence? Then tune in to Confidence on Demand
It's the topic on Monday's December 17th Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Renowned peak performance expert Pete Siegel joins Vicki for a lively discussion that'll give you the tools to step out with power. No more lurking in the background or second-guessing yourself. Learn to develop confidence on demand right here, Monday, December 17th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Check out conversationslive.net for more information.